But what I'm seeing now is more and more communities getting together, you know, from me to we, if you like. There's sort of moving from an individual concern with diet to an understanding that there are some bigger structural issues that need to be taken on, which is why you're seeing these sort of food policy councils pop up all over the place, not just in, you know, the sort of big metropolitan areas, but actually discussions are happening in a range of places. And I find that tremendously heartening, that we are moving to considering food in the same way that we, you know, we've moved now to see climate change as not the sort of thing that you can fix by, you know, having just by switching the lights off, but we need some big social change as well. And food is we're suddenly coming to the understanding that food is, it fits into that category as well, and that's for the good.
It's for the very good. So where do you see yourself going from here in terms of your interest in food politics?
Well, I'm part of a group that is going to be digging up the ground outside City Hall in San Francisco later on this year. And that's the first step in organizing and mobilizing around a local food policy council within San Francisco. So I'm very committed to supporting the development of what Brahma Mardi and what the People's Grocery call this urban agriculture 2.0. It's very exciting because, you know, we'll see where it ends up. But it's part of the Slow Food Nation events that are happening this summer. But beyond Slow, I mean, the success of, I think, Slow Food Nation's events this summer will be measured not just in, you know, the quality of food that's produced in September, but in building the foundations for more sustainable agriculture in urban and rural areas in the US and beyond. And that's work that needs to start now, and that's work that I'm fairly dedicated to.
It's been such a pleasure to be able to sit here with someone with such a depth of knowledge. And one of the things I have to say about the book that intrigued me so much was the perspective, the international perspective you bring to it, that the examples in the stories are not just United States stories, but that you bring so much of the Southern Hemisphere, India, Australia, and it gives you a broader, deeper view of what's going on in terms of our structural food policy globally.
Thanks so much, Evan. Yes, no, I mean, and it was, and I think, you know, at the end of the day, we are realizing that our fates are bound up with the fates of people in other countries, and that we do have a much, you know, our connections in the food system run very deep and run over thousands of miles, and the change does need to be global.
Thank you very much, Raj.
So
that was Raj Patel. His book is Stuffed and Starved. Any thinking person who also eats should really take a look and thumb through the pages. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'm the host of Good Food on KCRW, which airs on Los Angeles NPR station and can also be found on the internet, kcrw.com/goodfood.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We'll conclude with a talk by a familiar and favorite speaker on this show, Richard Heinberg. Heinberg is a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute and the author of 4 books on peak oil and related topics, including his most recent, Peak Everything. This talk was given at a conference, Positive Energy, Creative Community Responses to Peak Oil and Climate Change, held last March at the Findhorn Eco Village in the UK.
So last night I did a presentation here in the hall for some of you, maybe close to half this group, called Peak Everything, which is a condensed version of material that I've been developing over the course of about the last 10 years. This morning, what I'd like to do is try out some very new ideas that I've been working with over the past few weeks, and I have no idea if this is the right audience or the right occasion or the right material. It's all a big unknown. But you seem like the kind of folks who are okay with that. Let's go on a journey together. What I propose to do is to engage in an exercise in strategic thinking about where we are in the world, where we're going, and what we might do about it. What I bring to this particular discussion is the following. I've spent the last 5 years just traveling all over hell and back, talking to groups big and small about peak oil, mostly also other problems related to resource depletion and climate change. I have had a number of meetings with members of the British Parliament, members of the European Parliament, did have the opportunity to address a fairly large segment of the European Parliament a few months ago. I've spoken to national leaders in Australia, New Zealand, US, mayors, city councils, executives. I've spent the last year as a mayor-appointed member of the Oil Independent Oakland Task Force in Oakland, California, trying to design a plan for the city of Oakland to radically reduce its oil consumption. And also during that time, I, on one occasion, advised the National Petroleum Council in the U.S., which actually is part of the U.S. Department of Energy. I say these things not to sort of burnish my credentials, but just to say where I'm coming from, the kinds of experiences I've been having lately that have led me to suggest what I will be suggesting in the course of this presentation. I'm going to make 8 assumptions that will be the basis for the strategic thinking that follows. And these 8 assumptions are not things that would necessarily be obvious to everyone, so I think it's important to make them explicit. They might not even be assumptions that you would agree with, but nevertheless, they do form the basis of what's to follow. So again, I think it's important to make them explicit. First assumption is that global oil production is near its all-time maximum, and it's going to begin to decline within the next couple of years, roughly, and that natural gas and coal peaks are not far behind in terms of global production. Now, why would I say such a thing? many of you are already familiar with the arguments and data on this score, but just for the sake of the record and those who aren't, the fact is that these are non-renewable resources, and in the case of oil, we've been discovering less and less as time has gone on. The peak of discovery for oil was in 1964. So we've been finding less as time goes on. That's not to say that we're not going to find any more. Obviously, polar regions are now open for exploration. There's exploration going on around the Falkland Islands and elsewhere. But generally speaking, the field sizes are declining, the size of the fields that we're finding, and we're having to look in more and more difficult places. The polar regions, for example, these are environments that will be the most forbidding environments the oil industry's ever had to work in. So even if there's oil there, and by and large, the North Polar region is gas-prone rather than oil-prone, my geologist friends tell me, even if there are sizable oil fields there, it will take decades to begin to get that oil to market. This is the classic instance of peak oil in the U.S. When we say peak oil, what we're really saying is the moment when global oil production will reach its maximum and start to decline. It's not theoretical. It's inevitable. Everyone agrees with that virtually. And we've seen national oil production peaks in many countries. The U.S. peaked in 1970, early in the 20th century. The United States was not only the world's foremost oil-producing nation, but the world's foremost oil exporter in the 1930s and 40s. Well over half of all the oil being produced in the world was coming from Texas and Oklahoma. as you can see, once the U.S. oil production did peak, there were some strategies that were applied to changing that situation. First was more exploration, and that worked. The U.S. found more oil first in Alaska, an enormous oil province there, and then the Gulf of Mexico. And those things helped to turn the tide temporarily. Then there is the application of new technology for exploration, also for production, water flooding of fields, nitrogen flooding of fields, all sorts of things. Directional drilling, we could go on and on. And those things helped too, but all of those efforts together weren't enough to change the general direction of decline. The reason I say this is that this is likely to be the same situation for the world as a whole. There are people saying, well, yes, but we'll discover more oil. Yes, but we have new technology. Well, actually, most of that new oil production and oil exploration technology has been around for the last 30 years and has been applied first in the U.S. And yes, it does work, but only to a certain extent. Here in the U.K., oil depletion is a fact of life. Oil production from the North Sea peaked in 1999, and just in these last 8 or 9 years, production from the British area of the North Sea has declined by half. So that's some indication of the power of depletion. And so Britain, which has enjoyed this economic miracle from North Sea oil for the last 30 years, is now in the process of becoming a net oil importer once again. This is the best definition of peak oil I've ever seen. It's from my colleague Chris Skrabowski, who's the editor of Petroleum Review, which is an industry trade journal published in London. Chris was he's in his 60s now. He spent his entire life in the oil industry. And when he first heard about peak oil from Colin Campbell back in 1995, he said, no, this can't be true. So he spent several years compiling the data on his own and crunching the numbers and came to the conclusion that, yes, indeed, the world is very close to its all-time maximum of oil production. He defines the phenomenon this way: global production falls when loss of output from countries in decline, which includes now most oil-producing countries, exceeds gains in output from those that are expanding. And there's really only a small handful of countries that are seeing oil production expand. For the world as a whole, this is where we are today with, from the standpoint of regular conventional crude oil. Now, sometimes the statistics include other kinds of liquid fuels like biofuels, natural gas liquids, refinery gains, and I won't go into the technical terms, but if we just count regular crude oil, the world's been producing about 74 million barrels a day for the last 3 years, even as prices have exploded through the ceiling from not quite sure what they were 3 years ago. I think around $50 a barrel, something like that. Countries that import oil, like the United States and now increasingly Britain, rely not just on a general total production for the world, but really rely on the export market. And so what does that mean? Well, exports obviously come from countries that are producing more oil than they need domestically, and so they can sell the surplus to others. Well, there's a bit of a problem embedded in this, which is that oil exporting countries, of course, by definition, are also oil consuming countries. And as the price of oil skyrockets, that means that income to oil exporting countries is rising. So their economies are expanding. And what happens in expanding economies? People use more energy. They buy more cars, they build more highways, etc. And so in countries like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Russia, in other words, the world's big oil exporters, domestic consumption is rising very rapidly. In fact, that's where consumption is rising most rapidly in the world, with the exception of China. So Russia, for example, which has accounted for most of the non-OPEC production growth of the past 10 years, is still seeing declining but still real increases in total production. However, its domestic consumption has now overtaken most of that all of that increase, and Russia's exports are actually declining now. So if we do the math, the picture looks rather grim. Even though total global production past peak is only going to decline by perhaps 1.5 to 2 to 2.5% per year, available exports will decline much faster and could virtually disappear as soon as 2020 or 2025. I won't go into as much detail regarding natural gas and coal. I did discuss coal a little bit last night, and in doing so, I made a misstatement, which I'd like to correct right now. I was telling how the first scientific survey of British coal undertaken by Stanley Jevons in the 1860s suggested that Britain would have 9,000 years' worth of coal. I went back last night, thought about that later, I went back and checked my notes, and of course it was 900 years of coal. By a couple of decades ago, Britain had 90 years of coal left, and today the British coal industry is virtually gone. This is emblematic of what's happening elsewhere as well. The first scientific survey in the U.S. by the U.S. Geological Survey, undertaken in 1907, suggested that the U.S. had 5,000 years worth of coal. Now the USGS is saying that the U.S. has 250 years worth of coal. Now, what's happening to all these centuries and millennia worth of coal? Well, the problem is that these estimates are based on what's called a reserve-to-production ratio. You make a rough estimate of how much is in the ground and then divide it by how much you're using on an annual basis and say, well, we have so many years' worth. But R&P ratio estimates are never accurate. That's kind of a sweeping statement, but it's true for a number of reasons. First of all, it assumes consumption will be static. And in fact, of course, it never is. We've seen dramatically increasing consumption over the last century. And reserves tend to be overestimated for various reasons. So some very good work has been done over the past year or so by several groups looking at global coal supplies. And they've come to the disturbing conclusion that global coal production could peak within the next 20 years. So take all of these things together, the area on the bottom being regular conventional oil, then various forms of non-conventional oil or petroleum liquids or liquid fuels, then the reddish area, which is conventional natural gas, then on top of that a little dark blue area, which is unconventional gas, and then the sort of mauve area on top, which is coal, and we see total energy from fossil fuels peaking out right around 2010. So 2010 is not far away. Basically, I think we can say it's all downhill from here in terms of energy from fossil fuels. Now, that doesn't mean it's that we'll see a peak in carbon emissions in 2010, because what's happening is that coal consumption is expanding while oil and natural gas consumption is leveling off and declining. Okay, so that was assumption number one. Assumption number two is the consequences will be severe. Why do I say that? Well, it's on the basis of this study, which was done for the U.S. Department of Energy back in 2005, which for many months was available only on the website of a high school in Chula Vista, California. The U.S. Department of Energy was not interested in publishing this study that it had paid for. And when I found out about it, I worked with an organization called Project Censored to, first of all, to put it up on the Project Censored website, but then to more or less shame the Department of Energy into putting it on their website, which they did. well, the study was essentially to examine three scenarios, one in which the U.S. and, by implication, the rest of the world would start to work on the problem of peak oil 20 years ahead of the actual peak by developing alternative fuels and developing different transport infrastructure and so on. A scenario in which the work was begun 10 years before the peak actually occurred, and then a scenario in which we wait until the peak has happened and then respond to it, try to react to it. And this is the first paragraph of the 3-page executive summary of this 100-page report. And the executive summary says, the peaking of world oil production presents the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As peaking is approached, liquid fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically, and without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political costs will be unprecedented. Now, they've used this word unprecedented twice just in this first paragraph, which for government reports may itself be unprecedented. I don't know. But they're saying implicitly this is a bigger problem than the Great Depression or World War II. We've never seen anything quite like this. Viable mitigation options exist on both the supply and demand sides, but to have substantial impact, they must be initiated more than a decade in advance of peaking. Now, do we even have a decade at this point? Probably not, as we've just seen. So this is simply to say that peak oil is a serious problem. My third assumption is that there will be no techno fix. Now, this is a controversial assumption, I understand. What the techno fix that many of us have been talking about, or many people have been talking about for the last couple of years, is biofuels. And so, you know, sometimes a cartoon can say a great deal, and this one I think does. The man in the suit is saying to the starving child, excuse me, I'm going to need this to run my car. Whereas a year ago, environmental organizations, politicians, policymakers of all stripes were touting biofuels as the solution to climate change, peak oil, and all sorts of things. That conversation has changed dramatically just in the last few months as a result of soaring food prices, resulting at least partially from the fact that we're turning so much maize and soy and palm oil and other potential food crops into fuel for vehicles. Not a good idea. Well, that's just one potential techno fix. There are so many others, and it would take us the rest of the morning and longer to go through each and every one. And many of them are very good and deserving and will make a difference and should be supported. Everything from solar and wind and greater efficiency, more efficient turbines and a decentralization of grid systems and so on. But at the end of the day, the fact remains that something like 85 to 95% of our current energy budget is made up from fossil fuels plus uranium, which again is a non-renewable resource that will become scarce by mid-century. And there's really no, in my view, credible scenario in which efficiency and other energy sources can make up for declines in fossil fuels fast enough to offset those declines. So my fourth assumption is, therefore, society will have to power down. In other words, we'll have to reduce our consumption. We'll have to relocalize our economies because the whole project of globalization has been based on cheap transport fuels. And that's going to imply changes in behavior and expectations. We have all grown up in a world where the expectation was that next year we'd be going further and faster and we'd have more stuff to divide up among more people. That's an assumption that's going to have to change. That's an expectation that's going to have to change. And it has enormous implications. Fifth assumption, meanwhile, climate change poses a thorny policy challenge. Everyone wants to be seen to be doing the right thing, but enormous economic interests stand in the way of enforceable, effective global agreements. I won't go into great detail on that, but those of you who've been following the policy discussions around climate change, I think we'll probably pretty easily agree with this. There are some very good proposals out there, but let's face it, we have to get two countries on board any agreement that will have any real effect, and those two countries are the United States and China. There may be some motion in the United States once following the next election, but it's very easy for policymakers to say what they think others want to hear, meanwhile they continue with business as usual. And we've already seen that with regard to climate policy. Sixth assumption is that climate change makes global power down necessary. Meanwhile, peak oil means it's not only possible, but unavoidable. In fact, a global power down will happen. The question is, will it be policy-led? Will it be a planned process? Or will it be more of a process of chaotic collapse? So the powering down process will be complex, lengthy, and perilous. And finally, my last assumption is that, as if that weren't enough, these are not the only looming crises, nor even necessarily the most imminent. And I'll mention just one other small matter of concern, and that's the fact that the total value of U.S. dollar-based mortgage bonds is something on the order of $10.4 trillion, 30% of which is now expected to be lost in property devaluation and defaults. That's $3.2 trillion. And on top of that $10.4 trillion in mortgage bonds is about $540 trillion worth of related financial derivatives. Now, to put that in those enormous numbers in perspective, the U.S. total U.S. GDP is only $15 trillion, and the total world GDP, according to the World Bank, is currently about $48 trillion. This is why people like the Secretary of the Treasury in the U.S. and the head of the U.S. Federal Reserve and senior executives in the World Bank and other financial institutions around the world are losing sleep right now over the possibility that the world is teetering into another Great Depression, another financial meltdown that could include more bank failures and currency failures. So, how can we use this information and understanding about looming crises strategically to ease the transition and make the end result more satisfactory for people and planet? Okay, this is all very difficult information. Once we get over the shock of recognition, the shock of taking this kind of information in, then I think our next question has to, maybe that takes some time. You know, if this is new information, I'm not going to suggest that in the course of, 90 minutes we can digest it all and come out the other side. No, I think for most of us, it takes days, weeks, months, in fact, to really integrate this kind of information and then to be able to think strategically about it. Another assumption I guess I'm making is that many of us here have already gone through much of that process. So perhaps we can go on from here and think about how to use this information strategically. This little chart here is a suggestion about how we might think of the array of strategic responses. And this is probably not exhaustive. I'm sure that there are other kinds of strategic responses that don't fit into this chart. But nevertheless, I think this is helpful as a way of thinking about the situation. Top-down strategies that relate to changing government policies versus bottom-up, grassroots organizing kinds of strategies. On the one hand, proactive strategies that assume a kind of linear adaptation of society. We plan for changes in infrastructure and increases in efficiency and changing out of energy sources and so on, and and assume that we'll do this gradually over time, making investments and so on, versus, on the other side, responsive kinds of strategies that say, well, you know, that's all well and good, but maybe there will be some bumps along the road, and shouldn't we be ready for those? So responsive to crisis, policy that is responsive to crisis. Let's look at these in a little more detail, one by one. The bottom-up strategy is, of course, now famously being pursued by the transition organizations, towns, many relocalization groups in the U.S., and others. And the rationale here is pretty clear. You know, power holders are not going to lead this process very readily because they have so many vested interests. And so, you know, for those of us who see the handwriting on the wall, who understand the larger trends, it's really up to us to do what we can. And anyway, even if we do happen to have enlightened political leaders who understand some of this, the fact is they're not going to be able to do very much unless they have broad public support. I've been in conversation with leaders on so many occasions, members of parliament and so on, who in fact do understand the kinds of things that we've just been talking about, but they can't talk about them publicly because the general public is so far behind in its understanding of these issues, they would come off as sounding alarmist and crazy, and they would immediately be attacked by economic interests and the other party and so on as being doom and gloom and et cetera, et cetera. And so they don't dare do what they know themselves would be the responsible thing. But if there is a groundswell of public support for action on climate change, peak oil, related issues, then with that support, they can be bold and act. So grassroots efforts are extremely important, and at the same time, there's a limit to what they can accomplish, because sooner or later, the larger scale policy changes need to occur, because so many of the problems that we're talking about are global problems. Even if we have thousands of transition villages and towns and so on throughout, let's say, the UK and Europe and North America and New Zealand and Australia, spreading like a virus, if there's no such policy change in China, for example, game's over. So we need national and global policy change at the highest level if we're going to make it through this. So we do need some top-down thinking, and that's happening on the part of some aware government officials. If you've seen now the wonderful film, The Power of Community, about how Cuba responded, I'll talk more about that in a moment. Sweden has made the goal of becoming petroleum independent by 2020. A number of U.S. cities, including Portland, Oregon, Oakland, California, and now San Francisco is in the process, and others. There's an organization called Post Carbon Cities that assists city councils and mayors to undergo these processes of assessment and planning. You can find out more about them at postcarboncities.org. So there's a lot going on at this kind of top-down strategic level. The rationale there very clearly is that only government has the power to reallocate resources, build infrastructure, change laws at the scale needed, so we have to engage at that level. But of course, the limit is, on the other hand, as we've already said, that public officials tend to be tied to vested interests, and they can't really do very much until the public support is there. Well, proactive strategies are, again, ones where we look out ahead to see where we want to be in 10, 20, 50 years' time, and then backcast from there and make a plan to get from where we are to that end goal. And that kind of strategy is implicit in the Energy Descent Action Plans that Rob told us about yesterday in these municipal plans of Portland, Oakland, and other post-carbon cities. But there is a limit to these kinds of proactive efforts, and I've become very aware of those limits in working with the Oil Independent Oakland Task Force over the last year. We came up with a lot of, I think, very good suggestions for the city of Oakland about taking more responsibility for generation of electricity within the region, about changing out the transport infrastructure, taking out roads and highways and replacing them with trolleys and mass transit and dedicated bicycle lanes that are separated from traffic lanes and on and on. But at the end of the day, we present these plans to the city council, and these are people who are overwhelmed with what's already on their plate. And they're facing a situation where the city of Oakland, which is a city of about 500,000 people in a very wealthy part of the country, nevertheless has almost no money to work with. You know, it's fine to say, you know, tear down some roads and build electric rail, but to actually accomplish that requires an enormous dedication of resources. It's easier said than done. And meanwhile, crisis may intervene to undermine these efforts anyway. I mean, what if what we talked about a moment ago actually ensues? What if, in fact, the world is on the verge of a kind of financial implosion? Wouldn't that really undermine a lot of the really good proactive efforts that do require a lot of time and investment? So I would suggest that we also need responsive strategies. And I'm going to be talking in more detail about one potential responsive strategy, which I'm calling the Resilient Communities Action Plan. The rationale for this is that proactive efforts may be too little too late, but crisis could be opportunity. How so? Well, often real change, deep change, becomes possible when necessity requires it. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, we all stop what we're doing now and rush to the other side of the boat and start doing this other thing. What I'm suggesting is here is another kind of strategic thinking that perhaps we haven't devoted enough attention to so far, and that some of us might profitably begin to think about. So, crisis equals opportunity. There are historic examples for this. How I first started thinking along these lines was a few months ago. I had just spoken at a conference that Megan Quinn and her organization, Community Solution, put on every year in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And the day after the conference, the speakers and organizers all got together to sort of compare notes and say, you know, what worked, what didn't, what could we do next year, what does this all mean, where's the world going? And Faith Morgan, who's the co-producer of this wonderful film, The Power of Community, said, you know, I think it's significant that in Cuba there were these organic agronomists who had been promoting the idea of ecological agriculture in Cuba for years before the special period. No one listened to them, but when the crisis arrived, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the oil exports to Cuba went away, and Cuba found itself at the point of a survival crisis, at that point, then those organic agronomists were called in and you know, given the opportunity to redesign Cuba's food system. If they hadn't been there, if they hadn't already formulated those plans, that would have been the end. Well, that got me to thinking. Maybe, you know, we need to be doing something similar to that. Maybe we need to be, some of us at least, need to be in the place of those organic agronomists formulating a plan that, you know, stands no chance of really being implemented or even listened to outside of a crisis situation, but that when crisis arrives could make all the difference in the world. Second historic example is the Great Depression. In the U.S., the stock market crashed in October 1929. Initially, nothing was done. Year after year. This dragged on, and the economy got worse and worse. People were thrown out of their jobs, losing their homes, riding the rails, looking for work. It was abysmal. And at first, of course, the government just denied that there was even a problem. And then the government said, well, yes, there's a problem, but the market will fix it. You know, this is going to fix itself. It was only after about 4 years of this that finally it became apparent that something dramatic needed to be done. But there were already a bunch of economists who were following out the ideas of the British economist John Maynard Keynes, who were suggesting that the government needed to step in and create work for people, and might as well create useful work, building infrastructure within the country, electrification, dams, post offices, etc., etc., hire artists to paint murals, you know, whatever, but put people to work. And this was, of course, the New Deal, which with its alphabet soup of organizations that were jump-starting the economy in all sorts of ways. Crisis in this situation equaled opportunity to fundamentally remake the U.S. economy. And as a result of that, we had things like Social Security and all sorts of labor laws that previous to that time could not even have been really imagined in terms of actually getting them through the government and put into policy. Crisis was opportunity on that occasion. In World War II, we saw in the U.S. the Victory Garden movement, which over the course of just a couple of years resulted in 40% of fruits and vegetables being produced in people's front yard and backyard gardens, golf courses, etc., etc. It's amazing what people can do when necessity requires it. Now, crisis can equal opportunity in other ways, too. It can equal opportunity for people who want to take power. Germany in the 1930s is a classic example. In North Korea, the crises of the 1990s, where there were serious famines in North Korea, didn't lead to the same kinds of strategies there as in Cuba. In fact, it just sort of concretized, solidified an already existing kind of grim situation of military power. And there's a new book, which I don't know if it's made it here to the UK or not, by Naomi Klein, called The Shock Doctrine. Very chilling but important book, where she describes how the neoliberal and neoconservative forces in the U.S. have made it a deliberate policy of stepping in crisis situations to implement economic political agendas that otherwise would be rejected by the population. Think of what happened with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans just a couple of years ago. The government appeared completely incompetent, which it was in that case, and I think, you know, there are probably many people in the Bush administration who regret how this was handled. But very likely, part of the response was quite deliberate. What's happened to the city of New Orleans, which was one of the few Democratic Party strongholds in the South, it's become a Republican city. Why? Because all the black people left. Well, not all, but a great percentage of the black people fled the city afterward because it was their neighborhoods that were flooded. Crisis can equal opportunity for those who are ready and willing to step in other words. So if, in fact, crisis is approaching, doesn't it make sense that we should be thinking about it strategically as well? Not in the sense of profiting from it for ourselves, but in the sense of creating a strategy that helps society make it through the crisis as survivably, as decently as possible. So the essence of the idea I'm putting forward is that we should be thinking about creating coherent disaster response plans for peak oil and climate change and economic collapse that draw on the skills and knowledge of the alternatives movements. I'll explain what I mean by that in just a moment. And then that we should make this plan persistently visible to policymakers and the community at large. So what do I mean by alternatives? Well, low energy, low impact ways of meeting human needs. And there are lots of us who have been thinking about this for a long time in various ways. There's a whole range of human needs, and each one of those is addressed by some group of people somewhere who found a way of doing it that takes less energy, that uses more natural resources as opposed to petrochemical-based resources, et cetera, et cetera. Everything from herbalism to renewable energy and ecological agriculture, low-energy building retrofitting, transportation alternatives, on and on. We could, again, spend the rest of the morning just thinking through what alternatives exist. Well, in many cases, these good folks have been sort of siloed in their own field, you know, hacking away at the establishment, trying to expand their little market share, if you will, without any sense of cooperation with others who are doing in fact related things. Is it possible that these folks could all be tapped to produce a kind of coherent response plan? That's what I'm suggesting. And I've used the word resilience or resilient communities quite deliberately, but it's just a label. It's certainly not original. You've heard the word resilience on several occasions already this week. It's, I think, very aptly descriptive, but it's not patentable. And one of the reasons I think it's good is that it's non-threatening. You know, I don't think there are any members of the community who would not want to live in a more resilient community. There's an extensive literature on the subject of resilience in ecosystems and economies, and the qualities and characteristics of resilience are redundancy, dispersed system control points, dispersed inventories, diversity, balancing feedback loops. This is a whole presentation in and of itself, but I think most of you get the idea. So, in a little more detail, what would the creation of a resilient community, you know, quote unquote, look like? And here, with a tip of the hat to Rob's 12 steps, I'm going to present 10 steps to a resilient community. First, form a working group for the express purpose of creating a resilience response strategy. Second, identify the people and organizations within the community who have something important to offer in a crisis peak oil situation or a post-peak environment. And these could be everything from food co-ops to elders who remember how to do things in less technologically sophisticated ways, to people who are keeping chickens in their backyards, to who knows, let your imagination run. Ask their help and participation. Let them know what you have in mind and say, well, you know, we anticipate the possibility of the arrival of these kinds of crises. And your knowledge, your skills could be very important for the sake of the whole community. So assuming that crisis were to happen, how could your skill be deployed on a much larger scale? Let's say permaculture, for example. Let's say you have a permaculture group within your community. Okay, all well and good. It's probably represents a tiny portion of the population of your community and produces a minuscule portion of the food consumed within your community. Well, how could those skills be deployed on a much larger scale so that it, you know, you're supplying actually, you know, 25, 50, 75% of the food needed within your town or city? Well, obviously, that would entail, you know, building hundreds, perhaps, or even if it's a city, thousands of backyard and front yard gardens, finding empty lots and so on. How would you teach everyone? How would you? Where would the tools come from? Where would the seeds come from? Perhaps you would need to, you know, start training teams of people to go around and plant gardens and teach people how to tend them, provide them with seeds, and so on. Well, a plan is needed. Okay, so here's a process for creating such a plan. At the same time, I think it would be a good idea not to keep this process a secret from the sort of mainstream disaster management officials. Let them know what you're doing and why, and seek their input. The point is not to somehow create our thing over here. We're doing this for the sake of the community. So it's not an us and them situation. The more inclusive the process is, the better. So even contacting mainstream organizations responsible for water, food, power, fuel, healthcare, and so on is important. Now, many of them may not be interested in helping with a resilient communities project. Fine, but their participation should be solicited, because those who feel left out of the process are the ones who are most likely to try to undermine it. So we want as few people left out as possible. Once each of these groups has thought the situation, the problem through, and come up with its own kind of plan for deploying and expanding its strategy, then from those, assemble a coherent, larger, total community resilience plan, present the plan to public officials and to the community as a whole, and then, if and when crisis comes, implement the plan. And of course, without this step, everything that's come before is pointless. But then it's important, I think, to work with other communities to create plans on larger scales, national plan, perhaps even a global plan for resilience. And in order to do that, we simply repeat steps 1 through 9, I guess I should have said, at those higher levels. Okay, some obvious questions. Is there time to do all of this? Isn't it a huge job? Yes, it is. And I don't know if there's time. All I know is, from a strategic standpoint, something like this seems to be called for. Could there be resilient communities networks, certification, and so on? Perhaps. I don't know. This is all a very new sort of idea. I don't think that we could profit that much from, you know, creating a new branding of an activist approach, because there are already good people doing good things. This is not a new brand so much as a new strategy that can be deployed by existing citizens groups, transition towns, relocalization projects, and so on. But it does differ in some respects from what people are already doing. There are a lot of similarities to what's already going on in transition towns and other initiatives, but there are some differences. Most of what's already going on entails cultivating an upbeat, hopeful tone, and I think that's absolutely essential. We're not going to get the general public enlisted in what we're doing if we're all, you know, doom and gloom, crisis is around the corner, and so on. Nevertheless, disaster management, while it's a sobering activity, is strategically and practically necessary. If, in fact, we are approaching global crises, we have to be thinking about crisis management. Somebody's got to do it. What's in it for the alternatives movements? Well, by engaging in this process, they may become, in fact, the new mainstream, as happened with the organics movement in Cuba, which, again, previously had been invisible. Now, permaculture is mainstream in Cuba as a result of how that nation dealt with its crisis. What's in it for policymakers and officials? Well, when crisis arrives, they are going to be strapped for ideas about what to do, how to respond. And if the only people that they're hearing from are people who want to take advantage of the crisis for their personal or corporate gain, then that's who they're going to respond to. Policymakers need more options. They need more of an array of strategies to implement and deploy. So this is in every respect to their advantage as well. Where is the successful example of this particular, 10-step program? I can't give you one. This is the very first presentation that I've ever given on this subject. And so who knows? Maybe it's not even a good idea. Maybe it'll fall flat on its face. Nevertheless, elements of what I've been talking to you about do already exist in the transition towns, the post-carbon cities, relocalization projects. All that's really needed is for a subgroup within existing activist organizations to take a little different tack, give their work a little different emphasis. Again, I'm not talking about all of us shifting from one side of the boat to the other, downing tools and adopting an entirely different strategy. What we're doing now in many cases is absolutely essential, needs to be continued. What I'm saying is some of us could profitably start thinking in a slightly different fashion about disaster response strategies. Again, what I've been describing is only one of the array of possible strategies. So the question is, what's right for you? Disaster management isn't for everyone. Do you have the capability, the capacity to undertake a particular strategy of choice? Which one draws you? Which one feels good? Which one captures your imagination, makes you feel that your contribution is valued and important? Well, that's where you should put your energy. So I hope this presentation has been helpful to our collective thinking, even if it's perhaps a bit on the sobering side. Thanks.
Author Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute, speaking at the Positive Energy Conference last March in the UK. For more on the Post-Carbon Institute, visit postcarbon.org, and you can download an MP3 of this show and all previous episodes at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always